Hello, you're listening to the New Yorker Poetry Podcast. I'm Kevin Young, poetry editor of the New Yorker magazine. On this program, we invite a poet to choose a poem from the New Yorker archive to read and discuss. Then they read one of their own poems that's been published in the magazine. My guest today is the poet, memoirist, and translator, Jose Antonio Rodriguez, whose honors include a Bob Bush Memorial Award from the Texas Institute of Letters and a Discovery Award from the Writers League of Texas. He teaches in the MFA program at the University of Texas Rio Grande Valley. Welcome, Jose. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, the first poem you've decided to read today is World of the Future, We Thirsted, by Naomi Shihab Nye. What drew you to this particular poem as you're looking over the archive?
Well, I'm a big fan of her work, you know, and I've just always marveled at her, the serenity of her poetry. And this one specifically, I remember reading it in 2019 when it was published in The New Yorker, and I loved the title just from the get-go. I thought it was so expansive and mysterious, you know, very commanding, addressing the world of the future. And the imagery is really beautiful, and the sentiment and the questioning. There's a kind of humility in the poem that really speaks to me.
Terrific. Let's listen to the poem. This is Jose Antonio Rodriguez reading World of the Future, We Thirsted, by Naomi Shihab Nye.
World of the Future, We Thirsted. Stripped of a sense of well-being, we downed our water from small disposable bottles. Casting the plastic to street side, we poured high-potency energy tonics, or Coke, down our throats because this time in history had sapped us so thoroughly and we were desperate. Straws, plastic caps, crushed cans, in a three-block walk you could fill a sack. As if we could replenish spirits quickly, pitching containers without remorse. Who did we imagine would pick them up? What did we really know of plastic spirals in the sea, bigger than whole countries? We had never swirled in one ourselves, as a fish might do, a sea urchin, a whole family of eels. Did we wish to be invincible? Using what we wanted, discarding what we didn't, as in wars. Whole cities and nations crumpled after our tanks and big guns pull out. How long does it take to be thirsty again? We were so lonely in the streets, though. All the small houses still had noses, mouths, eyes from which we might peer as our fellow citizens walked their dogs. Pause helplessly as the dogs circle trees, tip their heads back for a long, slow slug of water or tea, and never fear, never fear.
That was World of the Future, We Thirsted by Naomi Shihab Nye, which was published in the July 19th, 2019 issue of The New Yorker. I loved how you read that, especially helping us hear those breaks. You know, like, had sapped us so thoroughly, and we were desperate. It makes it more desperate, I think, that and hanging out there. And the end especially is so beautiful and unfolding, even as it's talking about this kind of everyday, I don't know if it's horror or is it sort of the experience of the everyday that we know is true and we know there's a future, but also kind of helps us understand what's in danger in that future.
Right, right. There's a kind of quiet desperation. The speaker, you can feel the desperation in the speaker, but the scene that she's describing is the opposite of that. People are just sort of going about their day as if everything's fine, as if there is no plastic in the ocean, as if the bottles are just going to magically be picked up, right? And that contrast is really fascinating, really well rendered. And I love also, of course, the ending, you know, especially the last line. Repetition of never fear, never fear, because as you know, most of the time, I think when we feel the need to repeat something, It is, because saying it the first time was not enough, right? So rather than reinforcing the message, what we're communicating to the listener is a kind of insecurity that it didn't get through the first time.
Sure. Or that's not true. You know, it's like the more you say it, the less convincing it is, in a way.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah.
I think there's something else, too, in the we of the poem. And you know, someone else might be pointing a finger, or sort of a lesser poet would kind of make it less inclusive. And there's something about the culpability of the entire we, of the world, especially a world looking at the future, that is really powerful in the poem. And I wonder how you think about the we. Does it shift at all?
Well, I agree. I think that it's always tricky to bring in we, because, you know, the reader can resist being lumped in, right, with whatever's happening in the poem. But the poet just is so filled with a desire to understand rather than to judge or accuse. And so we have the questions, why did we want to do this? Did we just assume? And so the speaker implicates herself in the we, does not separate herself from this we that is, so it's the opposite of othering the reader. I think that's part of why it's so welcoming. And the shift, I mean, it becomes, the title is very broad, of course, World of the Future. And then I do think that, at least for me, by the end of the poem, it becomes very personal. It's very really I, because it's mentioning really the speaker peering out of her home, right? And watching the people passing by. And it feels very, very intimate by the end.
Well, and the question of the second stanza, which is two questions really, and there's the long one that starts, what did we really know of plastic spirals in the sea? Bigger than whole countries, we had never swirled in one ourselves, as a fish might do a sea urchin. You know, there's this kind of oceanography that happens there, and that ends with war, you know, ends with catastrophe. And I think, you know, it's so powerful, and it's from a few years ago, but it's one of these things that is just evergreen as a question. Using what we wanted, discarding what we didn't, as in wars, whole cities and nations crumpled after our tanks and big guns pull out. And then it goes to this other question. How long does it take to be thirsty again? What an amazing question. I mean, you know, someone else would just be like, I've hit the biggest thing. I'm talking about catastrophe, world war.
That's right.
But now I'm going to talk about thirst. And I think that shift is so powerful. And for me, that's where a lot of that happens. It becomes intimate, as you're mentioning.
Yes. I mean, that question is a haunting question, for sure. How long does it take to be thirsty again? And you're right. It comes right after this big monumental sort of subject matter of all subject matters, right? That speaks to one of the big questions about humanity, right? This drive towards violence versus this drive towards love. For me, that question, how long does it take to be thirsty again? It speaks to the relationship between desire and the quenching of it. And there's the small desires of the literal quenching of thirst. And there's the monumental desires of conquest and domination. And the poem just beautifully sort of tackles both.
Yeah. Well, and the order of the stanzas is perfect in the sense that it goes from this big, and I think sometimes it's somewhat funny. You know, the humor we haven't mentioned aloud, but there's something funny about, you know, we poured high potency energy tonics or coke down our throats, you know, because this time in history, you know, had sapped us so thoroughly. And so there's this kind of wryness, but even also almost bold back and forth, bright colored neon of that. And then it gets intimate, as you said, in the end. And any other order, I think it wouldn't work quite as well, because it feels almost like if you were seeing it as a movie, it would be really close, but sort of moving along with someone zooms way out, and that's where someone else might stop. But she manages in the poem to zoom back in at the end. I love that.
Me too, and keeps it odd with those strange images, like the small houses that still had noses, mouths, and eyes. I just am haunted by that in the best way.
I love that, yeah. And then eyes from which we might peer as our fellow brake citizens walk their dogs, pause helplessly as the dogs, you know, and we don't know what the dogs are going to do. We think they're going to do their business, but then they take a long, slow slug. And that's a great break, too, because, of course, a slug has other meanings of water or tea and never fear, never fear.
Yeah. Yeah, it's quite an interesting idiosyncratic poem, but it is, I feel very, it's very her, you know?
And what do you think about how to make the sounds of the poem? Do you think they match some of the mood we're talking about? Are they more elegant than the topic? How do they work for us as listeners?
I feel like the sounds are more, at least for me, they stood out more in the smaller moments rather than sort of like the big moments of in the second stanza. They're more obvious, I feel, in the first and the last stanza. For example, with the straws, plastic caps, crushed cans in a block walk, you could feel all those K's.
Yes.
It's very melodic.
Well, casting the plastic to street side, we poured high potency energy tonics or Coke. You know, there is this undersong that I think we could pass over, and I don't want to because it's so architectural. You know, there is this kind of architecture of sounds in the poem. And then in the second stanza, when it gets big, as you're saying, I would say there's all these S sounds from spirits to remorse, spirals in the sea, swirled, and even sea urchin, a whole family of eels.
These eels.
kind of a different nomenclature, sense of a family of animals almost, that I think also speaks to that kind of human animal that she's trying to wrestle with. And then we end with these more domestic animals, the dog at the end. But also the houses almost are animalistic. Or maybe they're peopleistic, humanized.
Right, or maybe they're both. I just thought of that because you highlighted the presence of the animals in the poem. When I read noses, mouths, and eyes, I thought, oh, okay, like the association I made is that our dwellings are expressions of our humanity, and so to destroy them either by littering, and or by war, is to destroy ourselves, or threaten to anyway.
I love that.
But it is very mysterious to think of houses. I mean, we've all seen homes that that can be anthropomorphized, but it's rare to see it so explicitly done in a poem like this.
Well, and it's also, they still had, which means that they always did. You know, like there's a kind of assumption in the poem. And I think there's something about that tone of not just confidence, but also of almost like it's too late. Like there's almost a sense of the poem of history having happened. And that's certainly some of what I think the first stanza has us think about. This time in history had sapped us so thoroughly and we were desperate. Now there's that humor and the ironies we're talking about. But there is this kind of almost, is it an acceptance or a defiance or is it a kind of relinquishing? I'm not saying that that's what we're ultimately left with. I think we're left with questions. But I also think there's a way in which the speaker knows all of this.
There is a kind of wisdom here, for sure, right? The speaker feels wise in her questioning and her generosity towards the world that is littering and the tanks and the big guns. It's hard to say. I come back to the last line, never fear, never fear, which reveals fear.
right.
It seems to end on not the most positive of sentiments. Although there might be a way in which acknowledging fear might be the beginning of righting our wrongs.
Well said. And I think it also implies a kind of future that the beginning declares, but by the middle, we worry might not happen. And then by the end, I think the work begins.
I like that.
Well, let's turn to your poem. In our August 22nd, 2022 issue, The New Yorker published your poem, Tender, which we'll hear you read in a moment. Is there anything quickly you want listeners to know who might not have read it yet?
You know, it's interesting you asked me that because I asked my students that when we're going to workshop their work. Any comments? You know, you don't have to have any, but any comments? No, I mean, it's certainly, I'll say it's autobiographical. I'll say it's one of those poems that came out of me. Like, the first draft was pretty close to the final draft, which is always a beautiful feeling. And I guess that's all I'll say.
Here's Jose Antonio Rodriguez reading his poem, Tender.
Tender. Thinking of how much my father loved flowering plants and how much my mother still does, and of how unfathomably hard it must have been to clothe and feed 10 children with the most meager of salaries for tending to citrus orchards, for shoveling and irrigating and shoveling again. How he groaned when I removed his work boots at day's end, an exhaustion deeper than any well. Mom says his boss was a jerk, nothing ever good enough. On top of everything, that empathy of her for him, who'd never listened to her pleas because the priest said, all the children God will allow. The priest, who never saw her afternoons slumped by the kitchen table, a blank stare into somewhere my voice could never reach. Nothing to do but walk away. I swear this is not about the unwanted child, or what a therapist called embodiment of the violation, but about the strength and will to cradle the plants, outside, the pruning, the watering, the sheltering, in found tarps and twine against the coldest nights. To lean into the day's hard edge and still find that reserve of tenderness for the bougainvillea, the hibiscus, the blue morning.
That was Tender by Jose Antonio Rodriguez.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson.
Oh.
Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. The jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
So powerful to hear you read it.
Thank you.
And I think the poem, for me, it almost picks up speed. It starts with these kind of full phrases and end stopped lines, periods. And then it starts to build on itself. And that long part after the exhaustion deeper than any well, mom says his boss was a jerk, nothing ever good enough, period. On top of everything, and it's almost like someone's telling you, hey, on top of everything, I'm going to tell you the actual thing that lies behind all of this. Or maybe it's around and unsaid, but also said here. Did that come naturally as part of the writing, you said?
Yes, I will say I feel like the first draft, the phrasing was mostly there. When I thought of on top of everything, I was thinking initially specifically on that, specifically having to do with my father's work and the boss and my mother's empathy. But I could, you know, certainly I hope it was always my. It has always been my hope that the poems sort of build intensity, right? Generally, maybe not all of them, but certainly this one. They build intensity and complicate the moment just enough before the closure.
Well, I wonder about this idea of that moment. You know, it feels like there's the memory of the flowering plants, but then also this memory of the boots, which I think is so powerful. And that tension, I think, in the poem between rest and pleasure and the, you know, sort of tending, as it were, and then the sort of tenderness of the feeling that the speaker and the mother seem to have for the father enduring this difficult work. Mm. How did you pair those, or is that just naturally how it came? But I want to kind of move past that into sort of thinking about the form of how the form re-examines that.
Well, no, I was trying to braid, you know, the different forms of tenderness within my childhood home, because it wasn't always, obvious, and it wasn't always possible. Life was very difficult for everyone in that home in different ways. And so, but there were these moments, and I was thinking about the moment between the speaker and the mother, and this and the child having to walk away, and the mother's just exhausted beyond recognition. But I didn't want to start the poem there because I knew that it was bigger than that, and I wanted to start, I guess, in the inverse of it, which is like actual connection, right? And then move towards that moment of disconnection.
Well, it starts not with I think or I remember, but thinking of how. I love that kind of gerund, and that happens toward the end with the pruning, the watering, the sheltering, and even, it's not a gerund, but the blue morning, these kind of sounds, these kind of rhymes that are occurring. And I wondered about that, and why start with sort of not the I, but sort of with the thought itself, if that makes sense.
I could have done it, I'm thinking. Could have started with I'm thinking. But I think thinking is a little bit more welcoming to the reader, because starting with I mean, I've certainly started poems with I, but not this one. I wanted it to just be a little bit more open and a little bit more, less, just not start with that very sort of declaration of the self, because this poem isn't so much about the declaration of the self, but almost, you know, the opposite of that. It's about community and about the... anyway, I'll stop right there. It's about community.
No, don't stop there. You're on a roll. I want to hear more about community and this the self, because I think sometimes when people hear autobiographical, they mm-hmm. think of only the self. But I think what you're saying is, I want to tell a story that I know, and I want to tell a story that I also want to learn more about. And I also want mm-hmm. to tell a story that isn't about just the self, but it's about selves, and it's about places, and it's about the things that all poems are about, you know. So I wonder about that. Mm-hmm. How do you zoom out, to use another movie metaphor?
Well, thank you for those comments, Kevin. The idea of the self is always in relation to the other, right? Always. And so for a speaker in this poem who's struggling with the sense of self, in this case, the best way to try and arrive at that is to look at the world around him and the way the people around him were also struggling with their sense of self, and how their struggle with their sense of self informed his sense of self. And so I think that's at the root of why I wrote the poem, or why it came to me. And even though the poem is very intimate, very personal, I know that my experiences are never only my own. You know, I am just one example of the lives of so many people who struggle similarly, either materially similarly or psychologically, with trying to build community first within the family, right? The family unit being our first community. And I was thinking about that when I was tinkering with the poem. The self is always in relation to the other, always in relation to community, always.
Well said. I love this part of the poem. A blank stare into somewhere, a little rhyme there, my voice could never reach. And with those couplets, you have that stanza break, which is almost a gap, a canyon here. I think that's so powerful use of form. And then this next line, which hearing you read it again and reading again, stands out to me all the more. Nothing to do but walk away, period, I swear. That kind of motion, that movement, is so powerful in the poem. Is it a walking? Why is there nothing to do? And it calls back to the beginning, thinking. You know, there isn't like I felt or the speakers, you know, it's nothing right. to do. It's almost like an activity, almost like a stage direction. How do you see that? Is it a repudiation? Is it an admission of this canyon? Is it a just turning toward something else? How do you see it in the daylight here?
I saw it. I think certainly when I wrote it, I saw it as, granted, I'm aware that the reader, of course, you know, just finishes the meaning. And the meaning of the poem doesn't begin and end with me. But sure. My intention anyway was that it was a sort of a gesture of defeat, right? Mm. An inability to connect at that moment with the mother, mm-hmm. who's just, she's there physically, but she's really gone. And then there's nothing to do but walk away, period, I swear. And I did deliberately put the I swear right there. Sure. Because when you read it or when you listen to it, the I swear, at least momentarily, can be attached to the nothing to do but walk away.
Right.
Nothing to do but walk away, I swear.
Right.
But then you read the next line and it turns out the I swear belongs to the next line
sure.
as well. And so I like that movement because I do feel those two lines and that space between them, the nothing to do but walk away, I swear, and this is not about the unwanted child, are probably the most emotionally intense lines of the poem.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to do the break there to sort of signal that, to introduce that powerful following line about being about the unwanted child.
Well, and I think that braiding you so powerfully did there, it's an example, I think, of how you do it in line break and how you do it with form and how these couplets are intertwined with each other. And sometimes I feel like couplets are these stark things, but yours feel like they're really vining around each other, and there's something organic about the feel of them, which I know is something one has to work at. The braiding that I think really mirrors the kind of organic quality of the poem. Is there more of the garden in what feels like it's part of a sequence? I mean, I don't know if you are working on a longer something that this is part of. How does this fit into that, if it does?
This poem is included in my next poetry collection, and I feel like it is one of the sort of like the anchor poems of the collection. But other than that, I think that's all I can say. Every poem that I write feels very just a work unto itself. You know, I don't know that I've ever written deliberately written a series of poems, right? Which I know some poets do. I don't know that I've ever done that. This just felt like it was one of the stories I felt I needed to tell.
Beautiful. Well, thank you for telling it, and thank you so much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you, Kevin, and thank you for your very kind words about my work. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely, Jose. Tender by Jose Antonio Rodriguez, as well as Naomi Shihab Nye's World of the Future, We Thirsted, can be found on NewYorker.com. Naomi Shihab Nye's recent books include Everything Comes Next, Collected and New Poems. Jose Antonio Rodriguez's forthcoming collection is The Day's Hard Edge.
You may subscribe to this podcast, the Fiction Podcast, the Writer's Voice Podcast, and the Politics and More Podcast by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. You can hear more poetry read by the authors on NewYorker.com and on the New Yorker app, available from the App Store or from Google Play. The theme music is The Corner by Christian Scott Atunde Ajua, courtesy of Stretch Music and Rope-A-Dope. The New Yorker Poetry Podcast is produced by Jill Duboff of NewYorker.com with help from Hannah Eisenman. Hi, I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor of The New Yorker. Each week on the Writer's Voice podcast, New Yorker fiction writers read their newly published stories from the magazine. You can hear from authors like Colson Whitehead.
Turner nudged Elwood, who had a look of horror on his face. They saw it. Griff wasn't going down. He was going to go for it, no matter what happened after.
Or Joy Williams.
Her father was silent. Slowly, he passed his hand over his hair. This usually meant that he was traveling to a place immune to her presence, a place that indeed contradicted her presence. She might as well go to lunch.
Listen to new stories or dive into our archive of great fiction. You can find the work of your favorite fiction writers and discover new ones. Listen and follow The Writer's Voice wherever you get your podcasts.
From PRX.